Have we gone? We've started. Very exciting. I got a lone clap there, as Spike Milligan used to say. A lone clap's better than two herps. Anyway, does anybody want to come further forward? I know you don't want to come further forward. I'd quite like you to come further forward, because then we can be friendlier and I can see your eyes. So if anybody would like to be friendly... Okay, I think that's great, lighting-wise. And this is the end, isn't it? This is the end. Da, da, da. Is anybody going immediately after this session, apart from me? A few other people. Got your cars all packed, tents down, and we're off. Endings are actually really important. Just like to say, I haven't started yet. Endings, this is the ramble. This is the pre-ramble-amble. Endings are really important, and there's actually research in happiness research. I read all the happiness research I can get my hands on. Research into how things end. One of the studies that they did was colonoscopies. Now, anybody had a colonoscopy? You might not want to admit if you have. Some people have, yes. There are people admitting they've had a colonoscopy. It's at best uncomfortable, I believe. There's a probe where you might not normally have a probe. And the study studied endings. So there would be a 20-minute uncomfortable colonoscopy for group A, a 20-minute uncomfortable colonoscopy for group B. But with group B, the probe was left motionless for the last minute. Group Bs are an awful lot happier with the overall procedure and are far more likely to come back. So endings are very important. I realize this is the end of green belt for some of you. So just like that colonoscopy, I'm going to remain motionless for the last minute and hope that it gives you a good experience. All the way through this, I'm going to pepper what I talk about with just some random quotes about happiness. None of these are jokes. So I won't refer to them, but they'll be up there on the screen. Now then, does anybody here, you might be skeptical. I'm kind of imagining that some people are possibly skeptical about the subject of happiness. I'm hoping some of you aren't and you're already convinced. I really think happiness, from the research and the journey that I've been on over the last couple of years, is actually really important. I mean, what does happiness enable you to do? I just made some notes just before we were starting, just before I was starting. I've started, by the way. Happiness can make you more attractive. It can make you more creative. It can make you more energetic. When you're happier, you're healthier. If you're a happy person, you'll live longer. All of these things have been scientifically studied over the last 8 years. You'll live longer by an average of 8 years. You'll solve problems better. And one of the interesting things, I think, one of the byproducts of being happy is you start to forget yourself. What about at a community level? Happiness is absolutely brilliant for building communities. It's good for getting things done, which is why I'm kind of calling this session Happiness Can Move Mountains Too, because there are other ways that we try and move mountains, but I think happiness is quite a good one. One of the ways that we normally try and move mountains, other than faith, I think this is drooping, I don't know. I'm referring to the mic, though, if in case anybody's confused. What do you think?
You've gone a bit flaccid.
I've gone flat. What should we do? Should we come up with another plan? What about the non-sideways plan? I had started. I've stopped again, so... No, you can't hold it for half an hour. Thanks. I'll figure something else. I'll figure something out. That might work. It means I can't see you. Sorry about that. Okay, where was I? How important happiness is. I think our natural inclination, and I'll come on to this a little bit later, our natural inclination is to focus on the negatives and to focus on the problems and try and fix them rather than focus on the things that are good. Okay, I'm starting again. I want to read you something that I wrote yesterday. Why are we here? Asked the rider. I mean, how did we get here? I'm not really happy here. Do you know, I want to go that way. I'll be happy if I go that way. But the rider is sat on an elephant who's got other, simpler ideas. The rider thinks he's in charge, but all he does really is act as an interpreter or a voice for the elephant, who, being mostly emotion, hasn't got a voice of his own. On a good day, they get on, and we call this cooperation emotional intelligence. On a bad day, when the rider and the elephant want to go in different directions, the problems only start when the rider denies the elephant's existence. The elephant always wins. He's an elephant. Which is a shame, because he's not primarily interested in your happiness. Just in case you're worried about coming to a session on happiness, I'm not American. Well, you probably gathered that by now. And actually, I'm not very happy. So in case you thought that I was some kind of American self-help, you know, guru, no, I can't do that. So neither am I selling something off the back of a cart, you know, the kind of American snake oil salesman. We do actually have an English version of this, which is, you know, happiness. What? There's no such thing. Stiff upper lip. Yeah? Mm? I don't know if you can read the what this chap is saying. He says, "I say, chaps, take guard. The alien rotters." I can't read it myself. "The alien rotters we must beat just don't follow the rules of cricket." So I think in this country we have this idea that happiness is about grinning and bearing it and, you know, being strong-minded and whatever. So why do I think that happiness is important? Why do I think right now happiness is a subject which we should be taking incredibly seriously? Here's a sign of the times. 2/3 of people in the workplace are unhappy, bored, or unfulfilled. Let's see how many people here. Raise your hands if you are bored, unfulfilled, cheesed off in the workplace. Marginally less than 2/3, but still a considerable number. For instance, look at society-wide. Lord Layard wrote a book a couple of years ago. Has anybody read Lord Layard's book on happiness? His big selling point really is that compared with where we were in the 1950s, on any given scale, we're doing far better, but our happiness is far lower. So what on earth's going on? Most people in the workplace are delaying possible happiness by 9 years, which is kind of sad. The Making Slough Happy thing found that TV has, at best, a mildly depressing effect. So when you come home from work and, you know, you need to switch off, you switch something else on, TV will have a mildly depressing effect at best. Soap opera is particularly not very good. We have a wider choice in society right now. That lowers happiness. We have higher expectations. That also lowers happiness. Okay, now, what are some of the positives that we can say about happiness? These are just some random quotes. This is not all I'm going to talk to you about, but I'm just going to dive bomb you with some random things that are coming up through happiness research. MTV produced a study last week that showed that the top single item that American youth are looking for as an ingredient that will make them happy is spirituality. Now, of course, I'm talking to you as deeply spiritual, wonderful church-type people, so that's why I'm putting all the stuff in here about spirituality. Faith community members report higher happiness. Married people report higher happiness over cohabiting people. Thanksgiving, forgiveness, and hopefulness are key mental habits to happiness. Here's another one from the MTV study. Sexually active teenagers report far lower happiness. Income above subsistence level doesn't really increase happiness, despite what the media and adverts tell you. People who compare themselves to others report lower happiness. So basically, in a nutshell, self-transcendent meaning within the context of community, exercised through kindness to others, is regularly shown to be the happiest state to be in. Individual spiritual practice does not foster this, but the UK church is in a prime position. In other words, through all of the secular studies, the reports show that the people that are happiest are those that are finding some sort of spiritual activity that they can undertake, not on their own, with others. That's a kind of crucial deal here, that some sort of exercise of kindness. In this country, there are thousands, hundreds, millions of people who are looking for this sort of recipe. That's their happiness recipe. And isn't the church in a good place to offer this? That's what I think, and I'll come on to my particular story about this later. So, who's heard of positive... I'm drooping again. Who's heard of positive psychology? I could just hold it. Is that all right? Can I rip it out of the... You might need to detape me. So, anyway, the Archbishop said to the... No, anyway. Okay. So, positive psychology. Who's heard of positive psychology? Psychology, obviously, has been around for a very long time. It was invented in 18 somewhere. Before then, there was no such thing as psychology. But it was invented, and the experts got their hands on psychology, and they invented depression and all sorts of terrible things that are wrong with you. They invented a great big book which helps psychologists and psychiatrists and counsellors and all sorts of things to agree on terms. For instance, this sort of psychosis over here, over in this country, we'll agree what the definition of that is for, so another psychologist over the other side of the world can agree on this. I forget what this book's called. Can somebody remind me? It's the DS something. Right. Okay, so, for instance, we're very, very good at measuring negatives. We're very good at discovering what's wrong and wanting to fix it. We're less good, says Martin Seligman, who is running the American Psychological Association about 8 or 9 years ago. We're less good at doing the opposite, which is about measuring our existing strengths, measuring the things that we are already good at and enhancing them. So he invented positive psychology along with a couple of other people, and the research has been taking off. I guess coaches, I'm a life coach, coaches have been using similar models for a long time. I'm not suggesting for a minute that psychologists, psychotherapists, et cetera, don't do this. Let me give you some analogies as to what... Oh, slide change. Here's a metaphor for positive psychology. What it says. Imagine you're in a boat and you're sailing towards a rock. If you're going to hit the rock is a problem, the rock is there, it's in your life, it's a huge dangerous thing. What positive psychology says, or what psychology so far might have said, is let's do all we can to get rid of that rock, because that rock is a problem. You know, everything about this is focused on the problem. What positive psychology is attempting to do is to build on existing strengths. So why don't we lift the water level up, for example? Do you know the Aesop's fable about the rain and the sun having a competition to get a guy to take his coat off? And the wind is full of bravado about how strong the wind is, can take this guy's coat off. Blows and blows and blows, and all the guy does is button his coat up even more. Whereas the sun comes along and just shines, and the guy takes his coat off. I think this is another metaphor for positive psychology. I'm going to read my notes in case there was something else I was supposed to say that wasn't. Is back. The mic stands back. I wonder if it... Ooh. Hey, levitation. Fantastic. Right. Now, I think happiness is really important. I'm going to challenge you with an idea. Can anybody tell me something that's more important than happiness? Now, I know this is taking us into philosophical areas, but in your life, is there anything more important to you than happiness? And I'm wanting you not to think philosophically about the whole of life. I'm wanting you to think about individual choices and decisions, the sort of actions you make, the choices between this path or that path or this job or this relationship, that relationship. Shall I do this? Should I do that? Is there anything more important than happiness? I should imagine a lot of you are thinking, yeah, of course there are. There's loads of things that are more important than happiness. When Aristotle came up with this idea, summum bonum, what he was saying is that actually happiness is the highest end. There is nothing more important than happiness. Happiness is behind, or the desire to increase happiness is behind every single action that you or other people do. It might be hidden. The way you can start to uncover this, I'm not necessarily saying I agree with this, but the argument goes that if you explore a motivation or a choice that you've made and you keep asking the question, why would I want to do that? Well, if I did that, it would enable this. Well, why would this be more important? Because it'll make me more happy. And what they're saying is that happiness is one of those things at the top of the ladder of asking the question why, that you can't get any higher than. Customers work with certain businesses because, again, this ladder, you follow this ladder because it'll make them happier. People go into relationships, in and out of relationships, because it'll make them happier. People will choose this church or that church because it'll make them happier. We can't get away from this thing, however hidden, being a very important motivation. In my own work as a life coach, I think when I was training as a life coach, I was told that there were two motivations that would help people change, really. They would want to change because they'd want things to be better in their life, or they'd want to change because they were moving away from something painful. About 80% of people are motivated in the latter category. They will only make a change in their life when they want to move away from something that is really difficult. Somebody said, one of the speakers I heard yesterday said, that you'll only change when the alternative is more painful. This seems to be true for, I think, about 80% of my clients. I don't know if it's true in your life or people that you know. Will resist change until the last possible moment. Now, I've got a rather painful story about resistance to change. I can't get over the fact that the tiny tea tent is somewhere different. Does anybody else, has anybody accepted the fact that the tiny tea tent is in a new place? Are you okay with a new place? Hands up those who are resistant, who are angry. The tiny tea tent is in the wrong place. Next year it'll be in the right place or we won't be coming. Okay? There's a big part of me that can't quite get used to this idea that the tiny tea tent is in the wrong place. Now, the thing is, the motivation to change things by negative motivations is not very good, because motivation to move away from something painful is a rubbish motivation, because very shortly you will be away from something painful, in which case your motivation to change will go and you'll be back to where you are. It's not a very long-lasting motivation, whereas I tried to work with clients to bring about, to get them to discover what their positive motivation to change is. It seems to be a much longer-lasting motivation to actually change. Okay. This talk, by the way, is split into three sections. I'm going to be talking about why I think happiness is important, what is happiness, and how do we get happy. So I'm in the bit at the moment where I'm trying to say why I think happiness is important. Now, ask yourself the question, what does happiness enable? I'm running an 8-week course in Bristol called Happiness for Life, and at the end of the 8 weeks, every time we get to the end of the 8 weeks, I ask the 20 or so people who've been on the course what happiness enables, why it's important. And listen to some of these answers. I can see everything more clearly. I can see opportunities and I can make decisions. I don't see others critically. I can sleep better. More understanding, more compassionate. I can focus outward more. I have more energy and spontaneity. Peace is easier to get. Enjoy everything more, work, interactions. Humor's there, more at the forefront. What about you? What does happiness enable for you? I'm more patient, I'm less likely to be alone, I'm just nicer, said somebody. We didn't think so, but we didn't like to tell him. So that's the end of my case for why I think happiness is important. It can move mountains. It's a fantastic motivation, particularly at the level of community. Instead of being a community that is about fixing something that's wrong, what about being a community that's about enhancing what's already good? Because when you do that, all sorts of other things can happen too. Think of us like a boat. Here's another metaphor. Is the whole above or below the waterline? The hole that we need to fix, the problem, the thing that's difficult, the thing that's rubbish, is the hole above or below the waterline? If it's below the waterline, sure, fix it. If it's above the waterline, forget it. Get up on deck, enjoy the sunshine, let's go on a trip, go somewhere nice. Okay, so what is happiness? Here is a questionnaire that is used by most happiness researchers to rate happiness. If you can't read the questions, you might need to come a little bit forward, but I'd like everybody to just diagnose where you are on that scale from 10 down to 0. Okay. Have you all done that? I didn't realise we were going to be in such a long, stretched-out, sausage-like venue, you see. So there's people right at the far end who I'm afraid can't read. Now, this is called the Four Dice Questionnaire, so you can get it on. It's available online. So have we got any tens? I'm going to rush straight through tens because you make me spit. Have we got any nines? Have we got any eights? Hands up. Eights. Have we got any sevens? Have we got any seven and a halves? Who were either kind of seven or eight. One. It's a lady in a green top. I really apologise for saying this, but you are Miss Average. Seven and a half is the average place where people rate themselves. The happiness course, which I've been running in Bristol, and it's soon to go be published for anybody else to facilitate. It's very interesting. One of the things that's disturbing me is that I'm getting quite a few people reporting themselves to be at one or two on this scale, which is very unhappy or pretty unhappy. They are all young men in their 20s. Exclusively, just young men in their 20s. I've done this twice, so this is no scientific model. So that's kind of interesting. Hands up who doesn't think that's a joke and is actually your definition of happiness. Okay. So here's my next part, which is let's have a look at passive happiness. Passive happiness is what's really being recorded by all the psychologists and studies and whatever population groups, if we try this or that. What they're measuring is what I call passive happiness. So this is the happiness that you have before you started to think about it. It's your natural underlying happiness. 50% of this is genetic. So your base level for happiness, 50% of it is genetic. You were born that way, sorry. 10% is circumstantial. So if you've moved somewhere lovely, 10% of your happiness at the moment will be circumstantial. If you've just been sacked, that'll account for 10% of your happiness. The last 40% is voluntary. Okay, so this is what they think. 50% of your happiness is genetic, you were born that way, and 10% is the circumstances in your life. We get this a little bit wrong in our heads. We sometimes think that the circumstances are way more important. I'm terribly unhappy, and I would be much more happy if I lived here, if I changed this job, if I had the change of this relationship, da 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 da. Those only account for 10%. I need to do something now. I want to do a little test. I want to take your photos. Imagine this is a group photo. We are all green belt people, and I'm going to be really cheesy, I'm afraid, and actually ask you all to smile. Hold on a moment. I'm going to get the flash to come up. Right, after three, I'm going to take your photo, and I want everybody to smile. Your best, you know, the irritating person who's still fiddling about with the camera for ages and ages and ages before you're anywhere near. And then finally he takes the photo and says, smile. Right, so everybody ready? What this reveals, this is another very interesting study in happiness, is whether you have naturally positive affect or negative affect. Now, again, you can't change this, unfortunately, but some of you have positive affect. You're just generally happy. Your baseline is just generally a happy thing. You may be even four on that scale if you diagnose yourself, but actually, you're actually quite happy. The rest of you are negative affect, you tend to be unhappy. Now, a study was done of American high school girl photos from the, you know, the yearbook photos that you have done at the end of the year. And what they did is they measured whether they were real smiles or fake smiles. Now, you can do this by, you can train people to be able to read the difference between the two. But I'm sure you know, when you look at photos, you know where people are genuinely smiling at you or whether it's a fake smile posed for a photo. Now, the girls that had the genuine smile, they followed up 30 years later. They were all girls with positive affect, very easy to put a smile on their face, And the results were startling. Relationships all lasting much longer. They were more likely to have got married far earlier and to still be with the partner. This is just more bad news for us negative affect people. I'm afraid I'm a negative affect person. 36 and still not married yet. Anyway, less about me. So I'm going to go through these photos later with a magnifying glass, the one that I just took of you all, and there will be at least half of you that I'm afraid are just, you know, the rest of your life is looking fairly dismal. Remember that 50% of it is genetic and you can't change it anyway. I don't sing because I'm happy. I'm happy because I sing. So here's another way to diagnose whether you are positive affect or negative affect. So read these statements. There's a group of four statements. I'm always willing to try new things, even if I think it will be fun. Those of you who are in couples, you can answer this for each other, talking about Greenbelt and should we go to such and such or should we just stay here and be miserable. I'm always willing to try something new if I think it'll be fun. If I see a chance to get something I want, I go for it. When good things happen to me, it affects me strongly. I often act on the spur of the moment. Is that like you? I worry about making mistakes. Criticism or scolding hurts me quite a bit. I feel worried when I think I've done poorly at something important. I have many fears compared to my friends. Now, one of those sets of statements may be more like you. You might not be able to admit it, so ask your friends which one you are more like. And here we have positive and negative affect. I'm really hoping that you're starting to get a little bit cheesed off with everything that I've been saying so far. Okay? Good. One last thing about your passive happiness. This is your set range. You are somewhere on that scale, remember, from 0 to 100. This is the place you return to, regardless of good things happening to you or bad things happening to you. You return to this level. They've done this study with lottery winners and paraplegics. Both return to the same level after 3 months. Further studies are showing that this is even after 2 months. The things in America, they did a study and there are 80 health conditions people would rather be dead than have. And yet, all the people that have these dire health conditions, there's no huge suicide rate. They're fine. We have terrible expectations about the things that are going to be terrible and unbearable. Now, here's your set range. It's supposed to be about 8%. So if something really wonderful happens to you, it'll shoot you to the top of that, and if something really terrible to the bottom, but you will gradually return to the same part. Okay? So what's the problem? Why are we not all continuously in the top of our set range? Try this little line. I can't remember if I made this up or if I heard it somewhere else. I'm not sure. I wish I could be the person I was when I wished I was where I am now. This is kind of interesting about happiness. You are, right now, as happy as the decisions you have made have led you to be. So if we had no tens, but we had a couple of eights, you know, you're doing fine. The rest of you, you are as happy as the decisions that you've made in your life have led you to be. In other words, this exposes that there's something slightly interesting going on with the part of us which decides on our journey through life and maps the route that we follow. It would be good if I did that and good if I did that. That part of your brain is a different part of the brain than the part that lives in the present and lives through that path. I wish I could be the person I was when I wished I was where I am now. We have a split brain. We have a brain that's split in lots of different ways. We know about the left and the right split. There's a split in your brain between your head and various other parts of your body which are capable of thinking for themselves. I think men are good at this. There's an ancient and modern split in the brain. Just where the ear is, and it doesn't show up very well on this scan, but just about where the ear is, there's a place in your brain which is called the limbic system. It's made up of the hypothalamus, the hippocampus, and the amygdala. It's the same part of the brain that you would have had if we go back millions of years and you were still a dinosaur. You still have that part of the brain. It didn't get replaced by a new part. it got built on top of, like a kind of rambling shack out in the wilderness. They decided to build another bit, and there's a lean-to and whatever, until this bit on the very, very outside is the most new, modern bit. It's called the neocortex. So there's the ancient and the modern. The ancient part of your brain is absolutely fantastic. It's been around, well, for a very, very long time. It's brilliant at what it does. It can do thousands upon thousands of things in a split second. It functions so well, you don't even know it's there. That part of the brain decided maybe 100 million years ago to add a new part, a part that was all about thinking into the future, forward planning and language, this new component. It decided to add on. That part, it might be 100 million years old, but it's still not very good at doing what it does. In other words, this particular split, this brain split, let's choose a metaphor, is a bit like an elephant and the rider that I was talking about at the very beginning. The rider is the new language component on the surface. The elephant is the old ancient thing. We think we're the rider. On a bad day, we forget that there's even an elephant there. Now, another way to describe these two parts and why they're really important to happiness, the elephant is your automatic thinking. It's all the stuff that you don't have to think about doing. Has anybody thought, as they were walking downstairs, how do I walk downstairs and then fallen over? No, it is just me. I asked this question yesterday and it was just me. The elephant is all the stuff that you don't want to think about, but it is brilliant at doing it. It's automatic. The rider is controlled thinking. At best, it can do seven things if you're a grandmaster at chess. Normally, it can handle about five computations at once, but best, it can do just one thing. So your controlled thinking, the rider is the one that plans your future journey. It's all about values. Wouldn't it be great if my value judgments, my systems, the things that I think will make me happy are these sorts of things and these sorts of things. They are a completely different set of rules to the elephant's rules. And the elephant is the one who's bringing you through the present moment. Now, the elephant and the rider, when they work together, is you at your best. But when the elephant wants to take you over, and it can do, it'll do so under a number of circumstances. It can even hijack you. Now, here are some elephant limbic hijackings. Run away. Now, your limbic system knows it's a snake before you do and will have moved you away before the brain, the new bit on the surface, has gone through the encyclopedia and gone, oh, it's a snake. But it also makes you a little bit stupid. You might be running away when you don't need to. Impulsiveness, got to have it now. The elephant can be very, very impulsive. The elephant is primarily interested in your place within the tribe. It's interested in your dominance. How important are you? When you walk into the room, the elephant is scanning very, very quickly your role in this group. How do you fit into the hierarchy? This is mine. Another one is the elephant is always on the lookout for somebody to mate with. This is of particular difficulty to the rider who's riding the elephant, because the rider is rather embarrassed about this, that the elephant is on the lookout for other people, because that's wrong to the rider. I think St. Paul had something to say about this when he said, the good that I know I should do, I don't do, but what I do do is the wrong that I know I shouldn't. What a terrible person I am. Another one is to retaliate. The elephant will retaliate very, very quickly before you've had a chance to think about it. So if it hurts, hit back. The elephant is not primarily interested in your happiness. The elephant is interested in only two things. Do I like that or not? The things that the elephant likes, actually I'll say it this way, the things that the elephant doesn't like, is scared of, wants to move away from, are five times more powerful than the things that the elephant wants to move towards. Which is why it's very natural for us to be hung up about the problems or the things that are wrong in life. It's far easier for us to diagnose issues and want to go and fix problems. It's easier for you to be much more concerned about the thing that went wrong than to be remembering the thing that went right. If in a relationship your partner has done something terrible, there can be, on average, 5 good things that need to happen to rebalance the one wrong. That's kind of how we're naturally put together. Now, just before I move away from the elephant and the rider, I want to say a little bit about how these two function brilliantly together. That's just another way of saying emotional intelligence. If you want to learn more about how to control your elephant, that's all explored in the new work on emotional intelligence. Has anybody read the book on emotional intelligence by, what's his name? Goldman. It's a really tough book to read, but it's got a few gems in it here and there. Okay. So I was just talking a moment ago about passive happiness, and I told you that you might be a negative effect person, that your set range is where you are for the rest of life. And I was hoping that some of you were getting a wee bit annoyed with me. Was that true? Or a little bit disappointed with what I was saying?
There's a man up the front who's telling me that I'm going to be unhappy for the rest of my life.
Rubbish. It's not true. There's a thing called developed happiness. Of course there is. Developed happiness is what the happiness course is. It's what my work as a life coach is all about. Developed happiness is when you try and do something about it. And the interesting thing is that when you get into developing your happiness, there's no evidence anymore that there is any genetic predisposition at all. So everything I've said earlier on, that this is your set range, you can't move away from it, that's certainly true of your happiness if you don't take the bull by the horns and try and do something about this, you don't try and develop it. If you do try and develop it, you can forget that. So this set range doesn't exist anymore. So here are some things that my advice, and to if you want to begin to develop your happiness, start off the journey by exploring the things that are pleasurable for you. Put in your diary right now something that will be pleasurable in a month's time or pleasurable tomorrow. Pleasures are the beginning of a 3-step ladder of happiness for a lot of people. Pleasure is what the positive psychologists are really just pulling together, is the stuff about your senses and your senses being fulfilled, your needs being met. The bad thing about pleasure is that it's happy for the moment that you're satisfying that need, but it doesn't last. So whilst you're eating the chocolate or the ice cream, that's great, it's making you happy, but that happiness doesn't last. There's nothing banked for later. Which takes us to the next area, the next level up. Now these are kind of things like your hobbies, the sort of happiness that you derive by using your existing strengths. I say hobbies because that's the easiest way in. Positive psychology is calling these gratifications or flow activities. What they do is they produce emotional capital. This is the kind of thing that you'll have to spend at another time. Now, the top of the ladder of happiness is the subject of purpose and meaning. Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi, who wrote the book on flow, very famous book on flow activities, which was the middle of that ladder, he said, it's great, you know, you can put together a life which is all about lots and lots of flow activities, but unless they are fitting into an overall purpose, you're missing something. Everybody is like this, you know? We kind of think, I'm imagining, and this is a sweeping statement, but we kind of think we have a purpose or we have meaning. Okay, so I want to say a little bit more about developing happiness. Developing happiness is an awful lot about changing the elephant. You can shift your set range for happiness in a number of ways. Winning the lottery, I'm afraid, doesn't work. There is actually a self-help group for unhappy lottery winners. There's an awful lot of things that media will tell you are things that will change your happiness, but interestingly, the things that do actually change your happiness, cognitive behavioral therapy, I won't say much about that, but I'll let you know that's one of the 3 major ingredients that will actually shift happiness. Cognitive behavioral therapy, there are a few different models of it around. The latest is actually a positive psychology version of cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's called quality of life therapy. You can do a search on Amazon, get the book. I'm speaking mainly to people that use this or actually know what I'm talking about. Those of you who don't, doesn't matter. The hugest thing... Oh, no, I'm going the wrong way. The hugest thing, actually, is meditation. Let me find the meditation bit. Number 7. Here's my list of things that actually do change the elephant. Change your explanatory style. Change how you are interpreting life. Think about how you interpret life in two ways. One, how you look to the past. Try and develop a habit of being thankful. Hey, that's another of our words, isn't it? Being thankful and finding forgiveness. This is the secular research is showing that these are key habits. Optimism towards the future. Savor pleasures. Don't blast through pleasures. Actually slow down. Turn the TV off when you're eating, etc. Find flow in hobbies. Join a faith community. Get married. Get some cognitive behavioral therapy. Meditate. Meditate. The secular research doesn't really know what to do with meditation, but they know through their studies that people who meditate are happier by far than any of the other interventions that are being measured at the moment. Structure meaning into your life. When I say structure meaning into your life, what I'm actually talking about there is to deliberately put meaning into your life in three ways, and I'm going to come on to that in a minute. Volunteer, and of course, develop your inner happiness before your outer happiness. So I want to say a little bit about developing meaning, and I know you may not be able to read the slide, but being able to put meaning into your life, both as an individual and as a community, I think we find, and remember I've said that finding meaning is the pinnacle of the happy journey, partly because it puts you in a place where you're forgetting yourself. Now, some questions I want to ask you. If you're looking for meaning and purpose in your life, calling, if you like, are you waiting for it to come, or is it one? Is meaning and purpose something that you make? Are you waiting for it to arrive, sort of passively, if you like, is going to land in my lap, or is it something that you can make? Do you need to be fixed before you have meaning and purpose in your life? Do you need to be all right and put together and, you know, have no broken bits? I don't think so. So if you're somebody that's looking for meaning and purpose, here's three ways that I'm defining the word meaning. Imagine these as a book. There's the first understanding of the word meaning is that having something at the very end. Harry Potter only makes sense, or an Agatha Christie novel or whatever, when you get to the very end. So there's a meaning that there is something at the end. The end for you may be the end of life. The end for you may be the end of a 3 or 4 year project. So see if you can work out what is meaningful for you in that definition. Remember, I've got three. That's my first definition. Having something that's at the end, whatever that end is for you. The second is the order of the steps towards that meaning. Imagine that your Harry Potter novel arrived in separate chapters that were strewn about all over the floor. The only way that you could make meaning out of it was to restructure those chapters so that they were in the right order that made sense. Okay? So in other words, if your end meaning is 4 years away, start to plot the right sort of path towards it. The most important definition of meaning, though, is our intention right now in the present moment. So you're picking your book up. What do you mean to do? Do you mean to open the book, start scanning your eyes across it and be thinking about shopping tomorrow or the argument you've just had or whatever? Or do you mean to actually read it? I want to say something that may be controversial. There was a slide that went up a while ago. It was a definition of happiness, and it was happiness is uncausable. Did you notice that? Did you read that? Happiness is uncausable. It's something that Anthony DeMello said in his book called Awareness. Of course, happiness is uncausable. The human ego is all about believing that happiness can be caused and trying to find ways to cause happiness. But if you believe that you are more than ego, that there is something in there that is more than just your thinking, in other words, more than just the elephant and the rider, you might be in touch with this idea. Try it on for size, that happiness isn't built up from a zero sum and added to. It's already there in you at the level of 100%. It's simply covered over. Happiness, perhaps, is a matter of uncovering what's already there and removing some of the ideas that we have that condition us to believe that happiness isn't ours. It's a weird thing to get your head around, but I ask this on the happiness course. Halfway through, these are just people that come who respond to an advert in the local listings magazine. I ask everybody, have you ever experienced a moment of a total 100% unadulterated happiness, bliss, whatever you want to call it? The very first time I asked this, there was a number of people in that group who I knew were negative effect people who'd rated themselves 2 out of 10. And if you ever asked them, in other words, you asked the rider of the elephant, how happy are you? You'd get a very low score. Everybody said, yes, of course, I have experienced the moment of total happiness where there was nothing else. There was nowhere I'd rather be. There was nothing I could change to it to make it better. In other words, it was perfect. The only way that you can know that is because that was in you. For a moment, the clouds parted and you discovered it was there. That's my experience. It doesn't happen to me all the time, but I know it's certainly true. And simply knowing that it's true is enough for some people. I'm not sure what I think about this definition of happiness. Be happy that your names are written in heaven. None of you giggling. I'm not sure that's what he meant, though. I'd just like to say very quickly, just to end, about this happiness course and the reasons why I've put it together. I'm somebody who's journeyed with the subject of happiness from a point where I couldn't have been more unhappy in my early 20s. I was one of those lads who would have ticked one of the one or two boxes. And I believe that my unhappiness was caused by all sorts of things outside of my control, you know, relationships breaking down, lack of success in work. I was really unhappy, and it was everything's fault. The line that I think saved me was reading that line of de Mello's, that happiness is uncausable. But my journey's been a long one since then, and I've become a life coach, and I've been studying happiness, partly because all of the secular work on happiness ends up with chapters, really uncomfortable chapters, because they don't know what to do with them, which is pointing towards the happiest people are those that exercise faith in a faith community, or meditate, or practice thanksgiving. These are all our words. What on earth are we doing about it? When I started to try and put on happiness courses, some of you may know I do the Read Jesus website, and I've created at least half the modules on Read Jesus. You know, you light the candle and whatever. Now, the one module which I proposed 2 or 3 years ago was an 8-week email happiness course, and I had to convince all of the directors more than any other module that there was an argument for this working. We can't do anything about happiness because, well, happiness is just selfish. We as Christians are all about selflessness, you know. And I had to explain, well, yeah, but that's where everybody's looking. That's where everybody's journey starts, in what's in it for me. But if you embrace that and if you help people through that journey, step by step, they will find their own way to this point where they're saying, okay, well, that's all well and good, ice cream and chocolate, all well and good flow activities, but what's my purpose? What's this overall meaning? This is a natural journey for everybody to be on. And at that moment, as a non-directive life coach, I never say to anybody, well, yes, I can tell you what your purpose is in life, what your meaning is. I ask people what they think it is. And I think about 70% of people describe something a bit like church. That's what they want. Happiness is about finding God by accident. 4 or 5 years ago, I had a phone call from a friend who got in touch through Facebook. Not Facebook, I don't mean that. Friends Reunited. Hey, all become Facebook friends of mine, and then I'll suddenly shoot through the roof with, and everybody else will be jealous. No, don't. That was my elephant speaking. Now, my friend phoned up and she said she knew that I was spiritual, in her words. She knows that I'm not particularly religious, not particularly churchy. I don't think I ever used the word Christian particularly, but you kind of know what I mean, I hope. She'd got in touch to say that she was living in Wales, sort of expat living in Wales. There weren't many, very rural Wales. She got together with a group of 6 or 7 friends to girlfriends once every 2 months to give each other 15 minutes to talk about stuff in their lives. They called it a coven, but that was a joke word, really. Okay, they weren't doing anything occult. But she was saying to me, you know, we know each other really well. We've been listening to each other's stories. What we really want is to explore spirituality together. Can you recommend anything? Can you recommend anything that we could use as a group to explore spirituality? I didn't suggest Alpha. Do you know what I mean? This group of girls, what did I have? What could I suggest that they took? I mean, there's 101 New Age books in the Body, Mind and Spirit section, which are all about how you as an individual can explore meaning and purpose and spirituality. But is there anything that we've got that's cringe-free that I could have handed them that they didn't need somebody else to facilitate, that they didn't need somebody else to come in and lead? Is there anything I could have suggested that didn't involve suggesting to them as a group that they got up and they went to a building and sang songs written 200 years ago? I'm painting a deliberately biased picture, but you know what I mean. We talk about emerging church, like, and I think what we really mean is either, oh, we're doing something cool on the fringe, so we'll call that emerging church, or there's something that we see happening that Christians are already doing, so we'll wrap our arm around that and we'll call that emerging church. What about the weeds growing through the tarmac over there? The Holy Spirit just getting on with it with this group of five girls. What do we have to give them to let them facilitate themselves? And this is where I started to ask. I have asked loads of people this, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, a number of other people, and there was nothing. So my humble attempt at this is this happiness course. It's called Happiness for Life. Now, one of the ways to facilitate it, these are three very quick plugs, is that I've put together a day training for churches, leadership groups, parachurch organisations called Happiness for Church. There's a leaflet at the back which you can take away about this. This is actually a way into Happiness for Life, which is this 8-week course which I've been describing. It's run twice in Bristol now. 70% of the people on the first one said, and again, I promise you this was non-directive, that they said they were interested in coming along to a group that was about exploring spirituality safely in a cringe-free way. 70% of the people on it said that they wanted to do that. I just said, would you be interested if such a group existed? And they said yes. Now, the last area of work for me is happiness for work, but I won't go on too much about that. There's time for maybe two or three questions. I'm just checking that with the powers that be. Timings. I've got 6 minutes. How many questions can we get in? Would anybody like to ask a question? Yeah. Shout loud. A question. In a nutshell, I put up a list about ingredients that are actually about developing happiness, and I put volunteering in as one of those. And you were saying, why wasn't philanthropy there? Perhaps, I mean, forgive me, but maybe I could include that in volunteering. But I think you've just made an adequate, brilliant point. I don't mean adequate at all. A brilliant point arguing for philanthropy, those sorts of things. The interesting thing is, how do you get people to do it? You know, can I ask another question? I don't think you can say to somebody, volunteer, it'll make you happy. I think you have to get them to do things, and then they discover that they've, oh, gosh, I'm happy, and I'm also volunteering. You've got to get the elephant interested in it. And remember, the elephant is interested in all sorts of fairly basic things. Anyway, yes. It's a really difficult question when you start to shine the torch on it. Is this making me happy? I think for Christians, I found particularly Christians find the session in the course that I do on session six, I think it is about purpose and meaning, just as I've explained it here. But it's session six of eight. So session seven is all about others, you know. Purpose and meaning is fine, but actually kindness and other people is an expression of that. You may be able to answer this for me, but Christians seem to have a huge problem with that session. They have a huge problem with the idea that it's okay for me to derive any kind of happiness whatsoever out of me doing something selfless. I don't know why that's a problem. It's not for me particularly. You can read Anthony DeMello's challenge in the book Awareness, when he says there is no such thing as selflessness, there is only awareness of our selfishness. But yeah, thanks for your point. The thing is, flow activities get you to forget about yourself. So a flow activity, very easily, very simply defined, a flow activity is something where your skill level and challenge of the activity are finely balanced. If you undertake some sort of activity where your skill level and the challenge involve are finely balanced, you'll find that that is a flow activity. In other words, your sport, your hobby, the thing that you enjoy doing, when those get out of balance, and one of the byproducts of that is that you will forget yourself. Okay, another question at the back. You might. Beatitudes are a brilliant challenge to all this thinking on happiness, and I think that they do expose that the journey which I'm talking about is simply just a foundation for people. I think I'm you know, somewhere right at the beginning. But yeah, the Beatitudes, one of the other translations of that blessed word is, you know, happier those. So yeah, something to ponder on. One more question, I think.